And now I'd like to go ahead and welcome Jerome S. from Corona. Come on up.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Jerome. I'm a grateful and fortunate member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And everything good and decent in my life is directly the result of the God I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not a has-been. I'm a never was. And that wine took me to a place where getting up just didn't even cross my mind. My sobriety date is June 6, 1973. I was 25 years old and my hair was black then. Right off the streets. Lights was on, wasn't nobody home. And what happened for me was nothing shorter than a miracle. An absolute miracle happened in my life. I met this girl. I met this girl in Camarillo State Hospital in 1972. She spoke four foreign languages. She had been all over the world. Her father was a career diplomat at the United Nations, but she was in the nut house with me. And she would say, Jerry, they're gonna have an AA meeting at 8:30. We could get some donuts, cookies, and coffee, and maybe we can get some cigarettes. And I got on the side of my neck, talking that slang. But out of lust and loneliness, I went to an AA meeting. Got lost in the preamble. Totally got lost. And I had been on Skid Row, selling whole blood every 58 days and plasma twice a week. My family had took me in numerous times and put me out numerous times. And there I was up in Camarillo State Hospital. She got out. And as soon as I got out of the hospital, 90 days without any alcohol whatsoever in my system, my family befriended me and took me back in again. And the very first day I get out of there, I'm drunk again. And the deacon is going to put me out of his house again. He would say, there's the door, let it hit you where the good Lord split you, and don't let it hit you on the way out. They practice tough love over there, them Scots. And she called me. She says, Jerry, do you want to go to an AA meeting? And I told my dad, I'm going to get some help. I'm going to get some help. I'm going to AA. And she came and picked me up to take me to this meeting. But my intentions was not to go to no AA meeting. My intention was to consummate our relationship. She was agreeable to that. She said, let's go after the meeting. I said, no, let's go before the meeting. And I badgered her, and she was just about ready to break in and give in to my will right in front of the meeting. And I made the best mistake of my life. I said, Bonnie, look, we don't need this AA crap. I'll sponsor you, and you sponsor me, and we'll keep each other sober. And it was this little old short guy, about 5'6", ethnically, socially, worlds apart. He just stepped right into the conversation, uninvited. He got all up into my face, talking about, I'll be your damn sponsor. And he said, Jack K is my name, and sobriety is my game. Call anytime. And I didn't like him interrupting our conversation. See, I would have did something, but he had three friends over there at the door, so I chilled. And for the next 11 months, in and out of AA, in and out of AA, 30 days, 10 days, my family even moved me across town to keep me from paid the rent. And that's where Bonnie came over there and she said, you know, Jay, I really want to be with you. I really like you, But I can't be with you drinking, because I'm trying to get my daughter back. And I'm trying to get my daughter back, and the only way I could do that is stay sober. And she left. And I sit there and kept drinking my wine and ended up in the DTs, audio and visual. Matter of fact, I'm sitting there on the phone. It was three women on the phone, and they were talking. And I called the operator. I said, I didn't pay for no party line. And the operator said, we haven't had party lines in Los Angeles since 1957. So I finally got my mother on the phone. That's the only person I could call. She said, they're having a revival over there. You ought to go let somebody. Oh, I just hung up. She sent my brother over there to get me in one more trip back to Camarillo State Hospital. And I was there for another 90 days. And what happened was, May of 1973, I had three visitors. The first visitor I had was my probation officer. Now, I'm not on parole. I'm on county probation for a $5 bag of marijuana. I was on probation for 6 years. In 1969, they want to put you in prison for marijuana. Oh, yeah, my dad had to get a lawyer, put up his house, and the weed wasn't even mine, because I don't smoke weed. It makes me paranoid. I don't like that feeling. But if I'm drunk, like my best friend Ronnie, he say, hey, Sonny, do me a favor. I said, what is it, Ronnie? He said, will you hold my weed for me? Oh, yeah, I got you. He saw the police. I didn't. And I'm talking about I almost got off of probation. I got this probation officer, Mr. Linker. He called me into court. He had violated me twice for being public intoxicated, sent me to Wayside Honor Rancho to be a hog farmer. Somebody from South Central don't know anything about hogs, but he had me out there working with the hogs. And he sent me back to court and told the judge that I think Mr. Scott's probation should be extended. So I'm talking to the public defender in this courtroom. I asked him, how much longer do I have to be on probation? And the judge interrupted our conversation. He said, there's no plea bargaining in my courtroom. For each one of those words, I'm going to give you an additional year of probation. How much longer? Oh, I was devastated. There I am up in Camarillo, and he showed up out of nowhere, Mother's Day, with his 90-year-old mother, taking mother for a ride. Oh, I thought he was gonna violate me when he walked up there. Oh, I said, oh man, I didn't report. Oh, he said, you know you're doing really something good. Well, Mr. Scott, I'm glad you're in this treatment program, getting you some help. And then he asked me, he said, could you show me how to get out of the south entrance of Camarillo so I could go to Port Hueneme? I said, yeah, I can show you. And I took him to his car, walked him to his car, and that's when he got real nasty. Oh, yeah, probation officers have that act. He got real nasty. He said, you think you're fooling me coming here? You're not fooling me. I've been a probation officer for 40 years, and I've seen people like you coming and going. The next time you get arrested for jaywalking or spitting on the sidewalk, you're going to do 366 days in the Los Angeles County Jail, and I guarantee you won't get one day of good time. You're going to do every one of them. And his little 90-year-old mother stuck her head out the window and said, good luck, young man, good luck. I'm on my way to jail. Oh, I was despondent. I was really despondent and depressed. And that very Wednesday, I got that second visitor. Tall Caucasian gentleman, 6'5", with a bulge over his heart. I said, what is the undercover police doing in the mental institution? Harassing patients, undercover cops. I said, well, he's not looking for me. But he was. He came over there and asked the attendant, "I'm looking for Jerome Scott." And he said, "There he is." And you know, you get that queasy spilling in your stomach when the police gonna get you. And I couldn't run. He came over and introduced himself. He says, "I'm a special agent from the Internal Revenue Service." Oh, yes, I relax. The IRS don't take tramps to jail. You have to have assets, hidden bank accounts, property. You got to have all those things. I didn't even have ID, so I know he wasn't going to do nothing to me. As a fact, I got real ornery and arrogant toward him. I said, "Do it look like I own any planes or anything? Why are you bothering me?" He said, "You know you owe us $14,000. See, my dad has sent these people up there to harass me in the hospital. I said, "Do it look like I got $14,000 sitting up in here in Camarillo State Hospital?" He said, "Well, when you get on your feet, come and see us." I showed him my foam slippers. I said, "Do it look like I'm gonna get on my feet anytime soon?" Well, see, in 1969, I worked at IBM. My psychiatrist, he had got me that job. He knew some people. And I take tests real good, but I'm a poor finisher. And so when I file my income tax, the form says if you have 8 kids, you get all your money back. It didn't say prove it, it just said you get your money back. But if you file for the first time with 8 kids, they want to know where you've been, so that's a red flag. Yeah. That third visitor, I thank God sent. Because it was Memorial Day weekend. And there was another young man on that ward that we shared the same sponsor. And he had that card too. "Jack K is my name, and sobriety is my game. Call anytime." And this young man called Jack Collect. And Jack left his home in West Hollywood and drove all the way up to Ventura County on the strength of a collect call to pick up this young man named Raymond. And my sponsor spotted me sitting in the mental institution on a Sunday morning reading the Los Angeles Times business sections if I had some stocks to buy. Well, I was checking to see what IBM was paying because I had bought 1 share of IBM stock in the employee purchasing plan. So 4 years later, I wanted to see if it had split. You know, it was bad business investment. And I didn't see him, but he saw me. And he eased up behind me. And he said, "Jerome, what are you doing here?" I knew that voice from AA. I knew that voice. From that meeting I would go to on Sunday evening, he was always there. And every time he saw me at that meeting, he had bum rushed me and said, "Jerome, how you doing?" He want a hug. I said, "Man, don't get up on me hugging." But I knew that voice. I didn't even turn around. I just said, "Damn, he done followed you to the nut house." But he caught me off guard. See, because one of my character flaws, I'm a habitual liar. I lie when the truth will serve me better. It just jumps out. Just jumps out. I don't know what I'm trying to protect or hide, but it just jumps out. And I told him the truth. I said, "Jack, I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know why I keep drinking like I do. I don't know why I keep coming to places like this." And he looked, and he didn't come from some spiritual mountaintop of superiority of AA knowledge. That man looked me in the eye, and I knew that man understood me, cared for me in a way even my own family could not understand and love me. I knew he was not judging me, that he had all the compassion and empathy you could think of, and he just simply said this, "Jerome, if you follow what I follow and you do what I do, you'll never have to drink as long as you live. And neither will you ever have to come to a place like this unless you choose to." I got a spot for Raymond in the original 12-step men's house. And I'm sure I could get you a spot there too. But it was Sunday. The deacon had sent me $67. It was in patient account, and I wasn't going to leave my $67 in the mental institution because I had some plans for that $67. I got all angry at him and, you know, got all huffy, like, I don't want your help and your pity. And that wasn't nothing what he was offering me. He just looked at me and said, Jerome, I understand and I care. And him and Raymond walked away. And I could not get out of that seat because of this thing. It's more formidable, more entrenched than any resentment or fear I could ever have. It's that baseless pride. You know that pride when you know you need help and you won't accept help. You'll turn your nose up and walk away and get angry because they didn't understand. Shoot, I got out of that hospital that Wednesday. I think it was that Wednesday. I got that $67. They give you a check out of Camarillo. He says, the First Bank of Camarillo. Take it down there to the bank. You don't even need an ID. Just show up to them. They know where you're from. Got my $67, went to the Greyhound bus station. The bus was late. And I got frustrated. I said, well, since it's late, I'm going to give me some refreshments. And me and the ticket taker in the Greyhound bus station, we sit there and knocked off 2/5. And I was so loaded on the way back, I got to the deacon's house, my dad's house, in a blackout. The only person on this planet that was trying to help his crazy son. I'm talking about jailhouses, mental institutions, hospitals. He would drag himself up there to the county jail, spend all day long with emphysema and heart disease, and always get to that mirror, that glass, and he'd ask that $64,000 question, the one I couldn't answer. Son, why do you have to come to places like this? Why do you have to act and behave the way you behave? And if I knew, I'd just drop my head, because I didn't know. I didn't know I suffered from an incurable illness called chronic acute alcoholism. I don't have a disease. I have a spiritual malady that is so entrenched in me that if it's not addressed, I become restless, irritable, and discontent. And if it's not treated, I become angry, separate, alone, and afraid. And if it's not treated, I become selfish and self-centered, rooted in fear and delusion. And I'm going to take something just for 5 seconds to give me some relief. I'm going to take something. Because I'm just that miserable and I'm in that much pain. I didn't know I had that illness. I got to his house and I beat him down in a blackout. The only friend I got on this planet, the only one that had any significant hope that his son would turn around. They called the police and I bust out every window in their house. And the police pulled up 3 carloads of them. And they was, I guess, I was trying to be provocative. They call it suicide by cop now, you know. Thank God a couple of neighbors that got out there, they was cheering me on. You know, I had an audience. So they had some benevolence, so they just choked me out, you know. When I come to on OR release, I get out of that jail and I come back over there. And I run and I see my father's sister. I say, I'm going to get her too. She needs a little beat down too. And I chase Auntie into her house. Auntie wasn't running from nephew. She was running to the back bedroom between the box spring and the mattress where she kept her regulator, that pearl-handled snub-nosed 38 pistol. And I'm in her living room. And I was getting ready to charge her. She said, come on, nephew. And then she cocked it. And all that bravo left, all of it left. You ought to see me get out of there. Over the fence, down the alley, behind the apartment building, in the trash dumpster, peeking out. Police got me again. Drunk in the same weekend, twice. And I came to on that jailhouse floor on the 5th of June. And all I could do is think about what that man had said. 4 days earlier, he said, if I follow what he followed and did what he did, I'd never have to feel like this again. I'd never have to endure that pain and that agony and that misery. And I made a commitment with Jerome. I didn't have one of those, oh, God, help me. Men, God is not on speaking terms at all. I said, if I could get off this floor, if I could make it back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to do whatever that man asks me to do. If he asks me to jump, I'm going to ask him how high. And he never asked me to jump too high. But I was real nasty from the jailhouse experience, so I broke into my parents' home. And I'm back in my brother's bedroom, and I'm getting his clothes. And my mom came back there. She said, boy, your dad said if you ever come on this property again, he's going to kill you. And I got smart with him. And she said, sonny, you might not be familiar with B.B. King's new record. She said, don't nobody love you but your mama, and she might be jiving too. And that's coming from your mother now. And she said, we old and tired, and we don't want any more violence here. If you can't come around any better, son, please don't come around. And I'm walking down that back step to AA. And she hollers at me. She says, sonny, I want you to know this. Mama loves you, but if you're an alcoholic, ain't a damn thing I can do about that. And I walked down to that Friday night beginners meeting at 9604 with my one day of sobriety. And this time I sat up front. I didn't hang out at the back. When they asked for newcomers to raise their hand, I raised my hand. And a couple of those old timers in that meeting says, get that guy help. Give him some help. And this guy was giving me a ride. He was trying to 12-step me that night. His name is John A. He had just celebrated 1 year of sobriety. And he was in a lot of pain. He was in a lot of pain. His wife had left him a note, told him he would never see his twin daughters ever again. He was a drunkard, and he was always going to be a drunkard. She didn't care if he was sober. She had backed to move his house. His house was empty. They just, boop, went ghost. And he was in a lot of pain because he figured if he had got sober in AA, he could keep his family together. And he was sorry in his pain. I said, man, look, let me out. I'm tired. I don't want to hear you. I said, I'm going to walk the rest of the way home. I ain't got no home. I'm walking back down the Skid Row to sleep in the show. And I get almost to Skid Row. And I hear God's voice. He just simply said, Jerome, if you go down the Skid Row, you're going down the Skid Row to die. And this time you won't be coming back. And I turned around. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. And I went and knocked on my dad's door. He had no, absolutely no reason to offer me any aid and comfort. I used to say it was out of love, but no, it was nothing but God's grace. Because I told him, I said, Dad, will you, he said, what do you want? I said, Dad, will you please, I said, Daddy, will you please help me? Will you please give me another chance, please? Because I think I found a way not to drink. Please help me. I ain't got no place to go. And that man said, go back there and lay down. But if you drink, leave this house. And I started making these meetings on a religious basis, walking any way I could. But see, when you get sober now, that don't mean your wreckage gets sober immediately too. No, it's a lot of wreckage. I'm talking about, I have these younger siblings and they would come over like clockwork. And they'd stand in the living room and tell my mom and dad, throw him out. Throw him out, he done stole from you. Look, he done bust out your windows. Get him out of here. And my dad would just simply say, well, he's not drinking today. Leave him alone. This would go on for not days, but weeks and months. And I'm talking about it was just getting to me so bad, that I felt like I needed to go drink. And I was on my way to go get drunk and come back there and do something. But I got down there to the liquor store and the paddy wagon drove by. I said, "Dad, what are they doing down in my mother's neighborhood? They're looking for me." So I turned around and I had some guy's phone number in my pocket. That's why if you go to meetings, get as many numbers as you can. And I called this guy. I don't know who he was. I just called him. He had gave me his number. I said, "Man, I'm in trouble." And he heard it in my voice. He said, "I'll be right there." He came and picked me up and took me to his job and held me on his job all day long until that urge to drink left. And I saw Jack at the meeting that night. And he gave me the answer how I was going to deal with how my siblings. Because I was perplexed. The only way I knew how to deal with it is get drunk, act out, and get put out. And he said, "Jerome, here's what I want you to do. I'm waiting for the miracle answer." He says, "Is what they saying about you, Jerome, is it true?" "Well, of course it's true." He says, "Here's what I want you to do. When they bring up your past, I want you to acknowledge it. I want you to acknowledge and says, yes, I did that. Yes, I behaved like that. But then I want you to say, it's been 3 months and you haven't drank and you haven't did that. And leave it alone." And for 6 months, I endured that. And they would laugh in my face. They thought it was cute. They didn't believe I was going to stay sober. But it's the uniqueness of that is that you get an opportunity to rebuild that respect. And I have that respect back today. But I had all this other wreckage like Mr. Linker. Oh, yeah, he was on my case. I had this lady in my home group, her name was Marion. When you come off the streets, you have no viable skills, no work record, it's kind of difficult. And nobody would give me a job. And I would tell them, I've been drinking, I've been on the streets, and they say, "Well, I hope you get it together." And Marion walked up to me at my Friday night meeting, you had to have 90 days to share. You couldn't have a burning desire. You had to be sober 90 days. You had to put your sobriety date in the book. And I got my 90 days. And I said, "Well, one day my ship is going to come in and everything is going to be all right, newcomers. Keep coming back. The program works." And she got up there. She said, "Jerome, you've been talking about that crap when your ship is going to come in. When in the hell are you going to send a ship out?" And she offered me a job. She said, "Well, you like the job mowing the grass, watering the lawn twice a week, and setting the trash out." I needed to get out of my parents' house, but I didn't want to get out that way. I said, "No, I don't know nobody doing that because you embarrassed me in the meeting." So she came up and asked me again. I said, "Look at this old broad in the meeting trying to 13-step a newcomer." So she asked me again. I said, "I need this job." I took that job. One of the best jobs of my early sobriety. Because, see, I didn't know Marion was a probation officer. And Mr. Linker violated me again. Yeah, he violated me. He came over to my place. I was living in this here converted garage, taking care of her property. And he came by there. He said, "You know, I have a letter coming from you. I want to make sure where you were living. I know it's coming, but I'm hoping he's going to forget." So he came by there, and I got this letter. But he sit out there in the driveway and talked with Marion for about 2 hours. I kept looking out there. I said, "Look at that AA talking about my business in AA." I didn't know they were colleagues. That she was speaking up for me, because Mr. Linker didn't send me to jail. He said in the recommendation that Mr. Scott has been sober now almost 9 months and it wouldn't be in the interest to put him in jail because he's made a fresh start. But he said, we recommend no jail time yet. And I said, wow, this AA stuff works. And I still couldn't find real work. But this AA guy, that's why I believe in the power of prayer. I didn't believe in it when I first got to AA. But this guy said, we're going to treat this spiritually. And he pulled outside of a motel. And he said, give me your hands. I said, is this a legitimate AA request? And he started praying that I get a job. And I'm sitting in the AA clubhouse, and the next day a guy walks in there. Says, anybody in here want a job? I said, dang, God, not so quick. I worked at that gas station in Compton for a while. And I went into a thrifty drugstore to have some Polish sausages and eggs one Saturday morning. And my psychiatrist, who had got me a job at IBM, he was sitting in there. I hadn't seen him in years. And so he came over and sat down. When he did a mental status exam. And he said, Jerome, it's something different about you. I said, I can tell you what that is. He said, well, what is it? I said, well, I haven't had a drink in almost 3 years. He said, you haven't? He says, I'm starting a social model program. Would you be interested in becoming a peer counselor? So my next question was, how much does it pay? Because I was getting robbed in the gas station every weekend. My luck was running out. But Jack told me I had to stay on that job a year to build a work record. So I said, well, he said it pays $11 an hour. I says, well, I can't take it right now. Can I call you later? I called my sponsor, Jack. I said, Jack, I ran into my psychiatrist. He offered me a position, $11 an hour, to be a peer counselor in his drug and alcohol program. I want to take this job. He said, well, Jerome, you can't take this job on the strength of your AA experience. You have to take this job based on your educational experience. I'll go back to school. Yeah, right. But I took the job. But I didn't like that too well because I wasn't willing to go back to school. So I took another alternative. I said, I'll go work. I was sitting there watching the mailman. And then I said, I have some mailman experience. I used to pass out handbills. You know, people going through the neighborhood passing out handbills. I said, well, that seemed like something I could do. So I took the test 39 times. People say I failed it 39 times. No, I got a perfect score 30 times and memorized all 9 tests. Which had 562 questions. It's a speed test. Because I had to have some extra help because I wasn't a veteran. And I had 4 interviews. And this one guy, because you have to put on the application, right? Have you ever been arrested? Have you ever been treated for drugs and alcohol addiction? The federal government want to know all about you. They want to vet you. I didn't know what that word meant. They want to vet you. They want to look everywhere. So I told Jack, I said, I don't remember all the times I've been arrested, Jack. Jack said, don't worry about it, Jerome. Go down to Parker Center, pay the duty officer $17, cash and money order, no checks, and they'll send off for your records on the Freedom of Information Act to the J. Edgar Hoover Building in Washington, D.C., and at the State Department of Justice. They'll get all of your stuff. So he wanted me to put all that on my application. I said, well, I don't remember all the times I've been in the hospital for alcohol. He says, well, we could work on that. So I had some extra attachments to my application. And I went to this interview in the San Gabriel Valley, and the guy said, I don't even believe you was going to show up. He said, but I'm going to give you your interview since you came up here. He said, over here to the right is where they case the mail, the clerks. Over here is where the carriers case the mail, and here's where the mail comes in. And he took me to the back door. He said, here's where the mail comes in, and here's where you go out. If you work in my post office, be over my dead body, and bam, and slam the door. I almost went postal before I worked for the post office. But me and Jack had a deal. I don't do nothing, say nothing, write nothing unless I talk to him about it first. Because see, the power of a drink comes a lot of different ways when you're sober. Sometimes it comes behind your behavior and your conduct. Sometimes it slips in through the back door with your thinking. So not that he was running my life, I needed a sounding board for him to reflect back for him before I could make any impulsive decisions, because I'm an impulsive alcoholic. See, I'll go 23 hours, 59 minutes, and 55 seconds, and I'll put up a gallon struggle. In that last 5 seconds, I'll say 2 tears in a bucket, and I'm gone. 5 seconds. That's why I need a sponsor. That's why I like Dr. Silkworth when he repeated in the doctor's opinion the phrase that was incorporated in the Library of Congress by Dr. Benjamin Rush in 1784. And he says this, it's almost verbatim. Men and women essentially like alcohol because they like the effects produced by alcohol. Although it is injurious, after a time, they can't differentiate the true from the false. They are restless, irritable, and discontent, having lost a sense of ease and comfort from taking a few drinks, which they see others taking with impunity, after they have succumbed to the desire, as so many do, the phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through a well-known stage of a binge, a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to do it again. This is repeated over and over. Unless this person has an entire psychic change, there's very little hope for their recovery. And strange as it may seem to those that don't understand that once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, that they had so many problems they despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control their desire for alcohol. The only thing required is they follow a few simple rules. Then he don't tell you what the rules are. See, for a lot of times, I was always making a partial change. That's stopping drinking. Not an entire psychic change. An entire psychic change is more than just physical sobriety. It's working towards mental, emotional, and spiritual sobriety. And I would just stop and leave 3/4 of my illness untreated. And it would drag me back every time. But what I heard, my wife came home and said, I know what the rules are from the doctors. I sit up in bed. I've been sober a long time, been wondering what was the rules. And it was this guy named from San Diego. He talked about the 6 rules. The 6 rules are, the first rule is you have to have an unchanging, non-negotiable sobriety date. That date is non-negotiable. Nothing is equal to it. Nothing is above it. Because if anything is equal above your sobriety date, it can claim it. The next thing is you need a home group. Now, there are a lot of meetings, but you got to find one home group. This is where you're going to go do your service work at. This is where you're going to show up when it's good, bad, and indifferent. This is where you're going to find a host of people to help you walk through whatever you have to walk through. You're not no visitor. You're not the first one in and the last one out. You're up front and you're here present. That's why a home group is really important. And I don't know about you. I'm a strong believer in strong sponsorship. I've had 2 strong sponsors. Jack was my sponsor for 37 years until he died. Now I got a new sponsor. He's a little rougher than Jack, though. Man. And see, a sponsor is someone offering sober people offering solutions on recovery. That's what he talks to me about, recovery. And the 4th rule is, it's important to take the steps, not work them, take them. Incorporate them in your life. And that's why I've gotten this loving God that I never thought was possible for me, that has done almost the impossible for me. and still does that today after 46 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I have found that either God is everything or he's nothing. Either he can or he can't. And I have to make this choice every day. Sometimes all day long. Sometimes I have to pause when agitated and overwhelmed and ask this source of power, what do I need to do next? Because I'm not in the business of running my show. Five more minutes? Thank you. I gave myself. That's why the steps are so important. And the fifth rule is, it's the 12th step. There's one activity that will immune you from drinking when all other activities fail. That's working with someone new. And the sixth rule, I didn't think was possible. Not for Jerome. Not a has-been. But I never was. I get to insist on enjoying life, avoiding the deliberate manufacture of misery, walking and living in my own personal brand of dignity, not making any excuse for my existence, having healthy, wholesome fun a day at a time. That's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I love about the fact that this new life that I have here in Alcoholics Anonymous is an awesome experience. And both my parents lived to see me get sober and stay sober. But you know what? It took 25 years for my mom to really believe that I was going to stay sober. Yeah. I'm sitting at my desk at the post office. I had just got my master's degree. I'm working on being a licensed therapist. And she called me up. And I picked up the phone. I said, what is it, Mom? I thought she was sick because she had diabetes. She said, you know what, Sonny? Me and your daddy took that policy out on you 25 years ago. And we've been paying on it and paying. I've been paying on it. And I don't think you're going to drink. So I was wondering if you would come over and sign it so I could cash it in. I told her, I said, I'll be right over there, Mama. She kept that policy. She went on a cruise with her new husband. And I was all grateful for it because they told me to, my dad told me, said, the insurance man is going to be here. And I want you here tomorrow because you're dying. You look like you're dying. And I'm not going down there to the church to ask them for not a dime to bury you. So I'm going to take this policy out on you, but you be down here to sign it. That next day, I shuffle up there, you know, with the heebie-jeebies, shaking so bad you can thread a single sewing machine running. I signed that thing, and my mom cashed it in after I got 25 years of sobriety. She saw her son get hooded for his master's degree. My sponsor was there. My wife and my kids was there. Oh, man, it was an awesome experience. Now, I've been a licensed marriage family therapist now going on, what, since 2003? And I'm enjoying working every day. I only go 2 miles to work, so don't make no sense in retiring to go watch the plants grow in the backyard. So I want to thank Inetta for having me here. I want to thank Brenda for having me here. And I want to thank each and every one of you for welcoming and giving me such a warm welcome. And before I stop, I want to thank Annie, for her talk. Thank you.
I won't even ask for another round of applause because I think we did a real